Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do you know about where your stuff comes from? While a fair number of consumers think about where their goods were manufactured and how factory workers were treated, fewer buyers are aware of how those goods arrive at their homes after they are ordered online. In fact, although we continue to pay little or nothing for shipping on many websites, my guest today has learned there is a significant human cost to the lightning-fast delivery we've come to expect. Mac McClelland is human rights reporter for Mother Jones magazine. Her article, "I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave," appears in the March-April issue of the magazine. Mac, welcome back to Think.
It's good to be here.
As I mentioned in the introduction, I think a lot of people who consider themselves socially responsible consumers have sort of missed this link in the chain from producer to consumer. But third-party logistics companies that handle the packing and the shipping of the stuff that we buy online, it's a huge part of internet commerce.
Yeah, I mean, all that stuff has to get to you somehow, right? So you can imagine this is a massive industry of companies that are paid to make sure that you get your goods extremely quickly. And you're right, it's not like people know, you know, that the conditions are terrible, but they're just like, I don't care, I want my free shipping. These companies have been able to get away with these sorts of conditions because really nobody knows yet, and we're just sort of starting to get the picture of how they have to do business in order to keep their margins high enough and their service so insanely fast.
And you don't name the company specifically that you work for, the third-party logistics company, not because you're trying to protect them, but because you don't want us to get the idea it's just this one company.
That's true. I mean, partly, you know, our lawyers at Mother Jones told us that historically the judges in cases where companies sue journalists who work for them without disclosing that they're journalists, the companies will usually win. Mm-hmm. And so our lawyers were saying, you know, this is definitely a thing that you should consider, just not naming them. And then at first, you know, we were like, well, that seems pretty unfortunate. But actually, this is super widespread. So naming one company, you know, would kind of make it sound like it was just that company, when in fact they all operate on the same business model.
And when you went in, you had no plans to lie about your identity, but you also hoped you wouldn't be pressed to tell the whole truth. It turns out nobody really cared as long as you had no felony convictions.
Right, and I had to pass a drug test. So, right, I was not allowed to lie. So if somebody had asked me any questions, but I mean, I put my current job and my current salary right on my application in the way that you always do, because I was not allowed to misrepresent myself in any way. But even the people who hired me were also temps themselves, you know, and they were cycling through dozens of people every single day. You know, there are people lined up to take these jobs, literally lined up to take these jobs. So, yeah, nobody was looking at me very closely as long as I passed my drug test and my criminal background check, which I did. So,
and Mac, this might seem obvious to you given the nature of your work, but what can you learn by actually doing this thing that you wouldn't necessarily pick up on had you done extensive interviews with others who worked there?
Well, I think that my, you know, I used to work in warehouses when I was younger. I worked in warehouses for a long time, actually. And so, manual labor is not foreign to me. But I still, you know, I went to college. I have a master's degree, and now I have a, you know, sort of fancy-ish, not like very well paid, but sort of fancy-ish job, right, as a journalist. And coming from that background and, you know, not having been in the manual labor industry for my entire life, my sense of indignation, you know, about some things may have been a little bit higher because it wasn't something that happened to me every single day. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of the people who work there are more used to it by now, you know, so they probably felt that way when they started, but you know, my sort of outsiders, you know, how can this really be like this? You know, that we were basically going to the bathroom against a stopwatch, that sort of thing. They do that several times a day, whereas for me, it's all sort of new. And so I pick up on every single, you know, disgusting detail.
Yeah. And not every warehouse you had worked in during your career had these kinds of, it's not like this is how warehouses go. This is this industry specifically.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure there are other industries that have terrible conditions in their warehouses, but I worked for moving and storage. You know, I was a mover, and that Yeah, it was a great job. I mean, I loved that job. But most of, you know, I've been in the warehouses of online fulfillment companies twice, two different companies now. And they were, you know, these companies were completely unrelated, but the conditions were exactly the same. And talking to people in the industry, you know, people higher ups in the industry and people, consultants who study the industry, you know, they'll all tell you the same thing. Hmm. This is how this operates because this is the way to make it the cheapest and the fastest.
Okay, so among the first things you were told by somebody familiar with this operation was, whatever you do, don't take it personally and don't burst into tears. When you heard that, did you assume it was hyperbole?
You know, kind of. When she said that, it was a woman who worked at the local chamber of commerce in the city of the warehouse that I worked in. And, you know, it was a small town, so everybody either worked there at some point or, you know, was married to someone who works there or their niece works there or whatever. So, yeah, when she said, just don't start crying, I was like, you know, seriously? What's going to happen? And then, you know, when she was explaining to me that they were just going to be sort of riding us in a way that seemed, you know, like we would just never be able to get out from under it. And she was going on and on about the goals and I wouldn't be able to make them and everything was going to hurt, but I just had to keep, you know, pushing onward. And, you know, as she continued talking about it, it was clear that she was being totally serious. Mm-hmm. You know, she was not exaggerating. And she wasn't trying to scare me. She was trying to prepare me and give me helpful advice. She didn't want me to get fired.
Yeah.
So that's why she was telling me to not start crying.
So what did it actually take for you to get the job?
Nothing. I mean, you have to, drug tests, criminal background tests, and you have to read. So mm-hmm. you have to pass a literacy test because you have to be able to get books and CDs, obviously, because that is a thing that a lot of people order online. So it took, I don't know, you know, 45 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. You just have to go in and spit in a, you know, in a little container so that they can drug test you and then pass those tests. And that's literally all mm-hmm. you have to do.
And I guess an early clue as to what the experience would be came during the hiring process. The staffing office is in like a part of town where lots of people are desperate for work.
Sure. Well, you know, that particular city, you know, a lot of downtowns are like that, mm-hmm. right? Like I could have been in Cleveland, where I'm from, or, you know, or Detroit. There's lots of cities where the downtowns are run down and there are a lot of people looking for work. So this downtown was no exception to that. There were lots of people who were, you know, flocking to this staffing office. And this staffing office had several other locations just to staff this one warehouse.
Yeah, I was amazed that they hired something like 4,000 people in 3 months.
Yeah, in the last 4 months of last year, they cycled through 4,000 people, partly because the warehouse is so gigantic and it employs so many people at a time. You know, mm-hmm. thousands of people work there at one time, but also because they're on a fire and hire model. You know, so many people drop out because they can't take it anymore or because they get hurt or because they're 1 minute late and they get dismissed or whatever. You know, the workers are so disposable that they have to have a ready labor pool, you know, every single day. They fire and hire, you know, God knows how many people. So they have to have staffing offices set up for that kind of volume.
So when you say they're fired for being 1 minute late, most of us would hear that and think, oh, you're just exaggerating or you're trying to make a point. But in fact, it's drilled into your head during the training process. Being quite literally 1 minute late, you're out on the street.
Yeah, during your first week, you're not allowed to be even 1 minute late, and you're not allowed to miss any minutes. So during your subsequent weeks, you get points, like demerit points, mm-hmm. you know, like you would if you were in high school or something.
Yeah.
If you're a minute late, then you get penalized. If you clock in 1 second late from lunch, you get penalized. And then if you have a certain number of points, you get fired. Mm. But during the first week, yeah, it's literally 1 minute. They told us probably 100 times. And, you know, we saw that happen. There were people who, you know, were late or who had to miss a day. There was a guy in my training class who had missed a day because his wife had a baby and they fired him.
And the amazing thing about that story, okay, so they fire this guy, they make a big example of him. He ends up getting rehired.
Yeah.
It would seem like that is just not good business for the company to go through this training process again, but I suppose it allowed them to have this great example of how serious they are.
I know, I was thinking that too when I was sitting there. I was like, this cannot be the most efficient way of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Just like retraining and going through the rehiring process for all of these people. But overall, I think the, you know, the value of keeping everyone totally anonymous,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, nobody knows who this guy is. It's not like he can appeal to some supervisor who is aware of his story and cares.
Yeah.
So, like, if you need to keep everyone, you know, just a number like that, I guess overall, you know, it adds up enough that it is the most cost-effective way to just fire people and then have them come back. And I mean, training only lasts, you know, half a day anyway. So even though it's a total waste of time for you, I guess it's not really a problem for them to just have you go back through it.
Well, you know, Mac, reading this article, two things occurred to me, two parallels. It sounded, A, like the conditions that we associate rightly or wrongly with like factory boom towns in places like China.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing that it reminded me of was these really, really kind of militarized public school systems in some parts of the country where the school system almost feels like a precursor for the criminal justice system.
Right, where you have to be stripped of all identity,
right?
And you just have to sort of like fit into the... Yeah, it is kind of like that. I mean, you really aren't anybody, you know, to pretty much anybody. And there's so little time to talk while you are on your breaks because you only have a few minutes and you have to eat something, you know, because it's a 10.5-hour shift and it's extremely demanding physical labor. So when you do have breaks, you have to eat fast, you know. God forbid you have children that you need to call and
mm-hmm.
take up another 4 minutes of your time in order to check in and see if they're okay before you have to run back onto the warehouse floor. So you can't really, you know, you can't really socialize. There's not really a lot of socializing going on. And it's funny that you mentioned China because one of the days that I think on my second day, you can go to the bathroom on your way to lunch, obviously, but I was asking a supervisor, you know, while I was working, can I go pee? Like, I have to pee right now. And he was like, of course you can pee. What is this, China? But then he was like, however, if you do go to the bathroom, it's going to cut into your productivity numbers,
uh-huh.
and you could be penalized mm-hmm. if you don't make them. So it's like, you know, he's joking that it's so much better. But in fact, you would get in trouble if you were missing too much time for going to the bathroom.
An interesting impression that you came away with was that the supervisors weren't necessarily horrible people. They were as much, if you want to use the word, maybe it's too strong, if you want to use the word victims, they were victims of the system as much as you were.
Sure. I mean, they don't want to work there either. You know, nobody wants to work there because people treat you like crap. So they have the same position as me, except, you know, maybe they made 50 cents an hour more, or maybe they didn't, and they'd been working there for longer, and their positions were more permanent. But they, yeah, I mean, nobody wants to be mean. You know, they're genuinely trying to help you. You know, I could tell when they, so they have to come around and tell you how you're doing, right,
mm-hmm.
based on your numbers. I'm supposed to be able to fill, like, 1,350 items in a day. And so I'm a little low and or a lot low actually, and someone has to come around and tell me how I'm doing and evaluate my performance. And you could tell they felt bad telling me, you are doing a terrible job. You know,
mm-hmm.
they were like, this is just not good enough, you need to get better. And they felt bad, but I mean, they have no choice but to enforce those. I mean, those policies come from, you know, the president and the vice president, etc., of the company. So they don't have any choice.
My guest is Mac McClellan. She's human rights reporter for Mother Jones magazine and author of the article, I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave, that appears in the March-April issue. If you'd like to join the conversation, we are opening up the lines now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mac McClelland, human rights reporter for Mother Jones magazine. Her article, I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave, appears in the March-April issue, which you can find on newsstands and also online. If you'd like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Mac, describe for us exactly what your job was in this great warehouse machine.
Sure. I was what they call a picker, and pickers are the people who, if you go online and you order a Barbie doll or whatever, you know, pickers are the people who have a little computer scanner in their hand, and a code pops up on their scanner telling them where in the warehouse to go, where that Barbie doll is located. So, you know, these warehouses are hundreds of thousands of square feet. And there are smaller ones, but there are also, there are ones that, you know, approach a million square feet. They are huge. So you have to find the right section and level and row and bin number, because everything is separated into, you know, meticulously numbered metal shelving units, mm-hmm. and find the Barbie doll. And then you put it in a plastic tote and you put it on a conveyor belt and you send it away to someone else down the line whose job is to, you know, stand still all day and put stuff in boxes. That's it. They just do that 1,350 times a day.
And you're not necessarily, I mean, you could have stuff in pretty widespread areas of that warehouse?
Sure. I mean, the scanners, you know, for efficiency purposes, the programs are designed to keep you as close to the same area for long periods of time as possible, you know, so that you're getting as many items as you possibly can. Because mm-hmm. the scanner also tells you how long it thinks you should take to find the Barbie doll. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the second the code pops up, it will start, the clock will start running down, and mm-hmm. it will say, you know, 20 seconds or something. So maybe you only have to go three rows over, although sometimes, you know, you have, it's much further.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a five-minute walk. But they do try to keep you sort of concentrated in little areas at one time so that you can get, you know, you can be as efficient as possible.
And if I'm picturing this correctly, the warehouse kind of looks like what people might have seen in a Sam's or a Costco. There's stuff right down on the floor, and there's stuff up pretty high above your head.
Right. There's rows, well, because they need to maximize the efficiency of their space, right?
Mm-hmm.
Space costs money. So the rows run from the very bottom of the floor to about 7 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like, you know, seven different levels on a shelf. It's kind of like a library,
mm-hmm.
actually, kind of like the way a library is set up, except for, you know, and some of it is actually like a library because there's books, but then some of it is full of, you know, crap like Barbies instead.
And so, God forbid something is not where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it's sort of the bane of your existence. If you go to a bin and you can't find the item that you're supposed to be looking for, you have to scan, because there's a little, you know, there's a little scanner in this computer.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do find the item, you scan it. And if you don't find the item, you have to scan every single other thing in the bin just to prove that you're not wrong, you
mm-hmm.
know, and you're not, in fact, holding a Barbie doll and you just don't recognize it as a Barbie doll,
uh-huh.
you know. So there could be 30 items in this bin, so you have to scan and scan and scan and scan to prove that it's not there before it will let you move on, which, you know, also is not good for your numbers.
Yeah.
Just be standing in one place and scanning things.
And we should mention you are young and in great physical health, not necessarily the case for all of your coworkers.
No, When they gave me the job as a picker, because, you know, the other jobs I could have gotten would have literally involved standing exactly in the exact same spot
yeah.
all day. So when they gave me the job, and they estimate that the people who do the picking, depends on the warehouse, but in this warehouse they were estimating that you run about 12 miles a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they gave me that, I was like, yes, you know, I'm pretty high strung. I like really physical activity.
Mm-hmm.
Like I work out a fair amount, you know, I thought that sounded like the perfect, you know, job for me, but I could not move fast enough to keep up with it. And because so many of the items are in such ergonomically disastrous places,
yeah.
like on the floor, you know, to get on your knees on the floor 800 times in a day is, you know, pretty taxing. Yeah. And there were a lot of people in there who were in their 50s and 60s. You know, I was on the younger end mm-hmm. of the average age of the people in there. And, you know, they were all telling me that I needed to take painkillers or at least Advil every day in order to keep up with it. But even, you know, all the Advil in the world, I don't know how they were doing that, like, at that age.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Kate in Fort Worth. Hi, Kate.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I really enjoyed your article. I read it in Mother Jones this month. Can you talk a little bit about what the term wage slavery means for Americans? And I think a lot of us don't really understand what that means and how it's even possible for an American to be stuck as a wage slave. And maybe if you could talk a little bit about just some of your coworkers and why they would even be willing to apply for a job that they knew had a 4,000 turnover rate in 3 months.
Well, I think it's just that they don't, you know, you don't have any options, you know. If you, these sorts of labor conditions couldn't exist if people had other job options. So the economists, you know, that I was talking to for the article and interviewing were saying, yeah, in theory, these people could demand better wages and they could demand better treatment. But in this job market, that's not really possible because so many people will need any kind of employment that they'll just take any kind of employment. I mean, it's like the woman at the Chamber of Commerce telling me not to start crying, mm-hmm. right? Seems like sort of a basic labor conditions that I should be allowed to start crying at the job if something hurts, right? Uh-huh. As long as I'm still doing my job. But yeah. Like she was saying, 16 other people are waiting for your position. So you cannot make any missteps because you will be immediately replaced. So certainly I can't go complain to someone, you know, about the fact that my arthritis is acting up. And, you know, one of the guys that I worked with, in fact, his arthritis started bothering him for totally obvious reasons. He went to the doctor. He had doctor's notes. He brought the doctor's notes back, and they fired him anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's totally common in this sort of a place. So you don't have any choice but to, I mean, you can accept those conditions or you can accept that you are unemployed.
And what was your base rate, like $11 an hour or something?
Yeah, mine was pretty good. I was hired at $11.50 an hour, which is great, I think, compared to what a lot of those pay. The one that I was in Ohio last year paid $9 an hour. And, you know, some of them pay less than that.
Mm-hmm. And there is, I had to look this up. I would have thought that constant forced overtime was illegal, but in fact it is not.
Yeah, right. I mean, in theory, you're like, oh, great, overtime. I can make more money because I'm not really paid that well and I need it. But their schedule of 10.5-hour shifts in a row, I mean, that's pretty grueling.
Yeah.
There were people who were talking about having to go buy new packs of, you know, low-quality underwear and socks because when you get off work, you're so tired and you have so little time before you have to go back again that you know, you can choose between going and buying yourself food and feeding yourself or washing your underwear. And if you don't have time, you just have to, you know, stop at a convenience store and pick some up and wear that. I mean, that's how tight this turnaround is and how grueling that schedule is.
And the warehouse is not close to where most of the employees lived.
No, it's in the middle of no place. I mean, it's in a town. It's in a pretty small town. And a lot of the people who work there came from one of several other bigger cities, you know, in the surrounding area. I mean, this was rural. Mm-hmm. It was really rural, out by the railroad tracks and that sort of thing. But a lot of people commuted an hour each way from bigger cities.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking to Mac McClelland, human rights reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, about her article, I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave. Let's go next on the phones to Don in Fort Worth. Hello, Don.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, my question, I recently had lunch with some hospital executives in Oklahoma, Texas, and I was shocked to hear that they were almost envious of the Foxconn business model in China. Very surprised. And being right-to-work states where unions are, well, let's just say they don't get an even playing field, did that ever come up with Mac? As far as organization of workers?
Well, I think that these warehouses and the fact that they rely so heavily on temporary labor especially, would make it almost impossible to organize by design. I mean, these people are, you know, are cycling through. They're in and out super fast. They can be, the same people are fired and then rehired and then fired and then rehired again. So you're not really settled enough in the space, and you know that, you know, your assignment is temporary. So those aren't really, you know, the conditions in which you would be invested enough to take the time. And what time do you have, you know, when you work 60 hours in 5 days, you know, in order to organize? And there's, you know, the breaks are so tight and so short that, you know, it would be difficult to talk about anything during, like, lunch, so you'd have to do it in your off time, and there's so many temporary workers. It's just, I mean, they have created an environment where organizing would be almost impossible. I've gotten, you know, in the last 2 weeks, I've gotten a lot of emails from people who have worked at places like this or who are still working at places like this, and nobody ever says anything about organizing. I think just under the conditions, it's almost impossible.
I was also really taken aback by the lack of privacy. I mean, I suppose the lack of autonomy is the reason you wrote the article, but the fact that everybody is sort of frisked on their way out of the building for fear they have stolen something, and there are no lockers for you to put your purse and your cell phone down.
Right. So if you want to make sure that your stuff doesn't get stolen, you just can't bring it in with you. But you're not allowed to go out to your car during a shift. I don't really know why, without permission. So if you want to call your children, which would be important if you had them, which I don't, you know, so I just left my phone in the car, which is fine for me. But if I had to check in with somebody or keep a phone on me in case someone who needed me was trying to get a hold of me, you know, I basically did not exist to the world for 11 hours at a time because I left all modes of communication in my car. But people would leave things in the break room. But in the break room, yeah, there's just like some metal shelves along the wall, and you just leave your stuff wherever. And the supervisors were warning us, you know, yes, things get stolen in here all the time, so you just have to be careful. You're not allowed to take your phone with you when you walk into the actual warehouse out of the break room because the company sells phones. And so you could have stolen that phone, or you could be talking on the phone or texting while you're supposed to be working. So it's, yeah, I mean, I needed to take my car keys out of my car, obviously. And the supervisor was warning me, you know, you might not want to leave them in this break room because they could be stolen. And it's the kind of, it was the kind of car key where if you, you know, you can press a button and my car will, like, lock or unlock. So a thief could potentially find my car.
Yeah.
But if I take my keys into the warehouse with me, then I'll be stopped by the metal detectors on my way back out every single time I need to go to break. So that, and then if I set the metal detectors off, then I have to be searched. And if my break is, if I have like 10 minutes and I spend 8 minutes of it, you know, going through a metal detector and getting frisked, then I can't eat anything or go to the bathroom. I mean, it's crazy.
It is. Well, I mean, the phone thing alone, I am a parent, and I can't imagine working somewhere where I might not know for 5 hours if, you know, one of my kids broke an arm on the playground.
Right.
We have an email here from Stephen, and this does come up in your piece, so I want to talk about it. Stephen writes, NPR ran a story just before Christmas about retired people in RVs traveling to these warehouse centers and doing this work part-time leading up to the holidays. They sounded like they loved it. I have some friends who are planning to do this. Do you have any knowledge of this?
Sure. There were 300 of those people. They call themselves work campers. There were 300 of them at my warehouse, according to them. You know, they sort of all stuck together. They were in their, you know, mid-60s to early 70s. And they had been, they were sort of the most knowledgeable group in the house because they do this at lots of these facilities. So they had been working, these people that I sat with at lunch just coincidentally one time, they had been working at a different fulfillment center for Amazon, I think it was, in Kansas City or somewhere in Missouri or something, and they were saying that one was a lot worse because it was even bigger, and so instead of 12 miles a day, they were running 15 miles a day, and, you know, they didn't care for that one, so this one was a little bit better, and they sort of, like, they'll tell you the tricks of not getting fired and, you know, trying to survive in it. Those people, mean, the ones that I talked to were not, I mean, they liked the freedom, I guess, of the temporary assignments. But I saw this husband and wife having a conversation where he was like, you know, are we going to do this again in a couple months when we need to get a job again? Because they were retired, but they didn't have enough money to just be retired. They had to have, you know, another job for income. And so he was saying, when our money from this job runs out and we need to take another job, will we take another job at a fulfillment center like this? And she was like, God, I don't want to. Mm. And I was watching them have this conversation, you know, and she was just, like, so tired and so over it. So I didn't meet any work campers who were super excited about this job, although one of them who used to work for some kind of sewage company in Alaska said it was way better than that.
That's setting the bar pretty low.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Gabe on the line in Dallas. Hey, Gabe.
Hi. Taking my call.
Sure.
Wow, I read that article and it was very moving. One of the most moving things I've read in a long time, and I wanted to. It's really amazing to get to talk to the author. My question for Ms. McClellan: who are your influences in writing? Because that really kind of, there were parts that really reminded me of like David Sedaris and Sandland Diaries.
Well, I'm really flattered. when I was in college, I was, I think, like everyone, a huge Sedaris fan. I think he's totally amazing. And some of it, you know, some people were saying some of this is actually kind of funny. You know, some of this, like, terrible, terrible stuff, some of it is actually sort of, like, darkly funny or ironic. And that, you know, that's not, that, those are just the circumstances. That's, you know, it's not any, doesn't have anything to do with, like, genius on my part. That just, it just so happens that, you know, we also picked a lot of sex toys and things like that. So I had a lot of really good material to work with. But, you know, my editor, Clara at Mother Jones, she was actually the editor for Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimes mm-hmm. piece.
Yeah.
Because that was originally a feature in Harper's Magazine. Mm-hmm. And that's where, and Clara worked there and was the editor on that piece then. And so I was actually thinking that when they told me, you know, we think you should go work in this. I was like, of course you think that, because you edited the very brilliant Barbara Ehrenreich on a piece about working undercover in a really crappy job. And I think she was right. I think it was a good idea.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. Mac McClelland is with us from Mother Jones Magazine. Her current article is called I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mother Jones Magazine's human rights correspondent, Mac McClelland. Her new article, I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave, appears in the March-April issue. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Mac, to go back to this idea that there were some darkly funny moments during this experience, it's clear that you recognize that there's also more humor, given that you can walk away when it's time to leave. And a lot of people are sort of trapped there. There's a really poignant moment at the end of the piece where you quit and all you can do is be grateful and realize how lucky you are that this is not your real life.
Sure. I mean, it's not like I don't appreciate the fact that it's an extreme luxury for me to not have to keep this job. I mean, maybe it will be someday, mm-hmm. you know, it just happens. I happen to be very lucky at the moment that I don't have to have that job. So, yeah, when I walked away, because I had been working in the books section that day. When you work in the book section, you get shocked. There's a lot of static electricity mm-hmm. problems in that section. So I've been getting shocked all day. So when I walked outside, I was like, oh, my God, I'm so lucky that I get to leave and I don't have to have nightmares about not being able to make my goals like mm-hmm. the rest of the people in this warehouse.
It actually finding its way into your dreams?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had that when I was a waitress, you know, I was a waitress at a very, very busy sports bar when I was in college, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you would have dreams that, like, you all these people were asking for napkins at the same time, you know, it's that sort of thing. But, yeah, I would have dreams that I was filling orders, and, you know, and not being able to do it fast enough. And everybody there did, you know, people would talk about that at lunch, like, oh, I had these dreams, I was having these nightmares that I, you know, for some reason I was moving too slow this day or whatever.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Chris on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Chris.
How are you this afternoon?
Very well, thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to make the comment that I'm very glad that this author came out and wrote this book, because I've been a warehouse worker here in the state of Texas, and I tell you, it's some different work. The people, it really is an impressive work situation, and it's a shame that, you know, that capitalism causes people to treat people like that. And that's just a comment that I wanted to make. People shouldn't have to work like that. I know, because I did it.
Thank you so much for your call, Chris. I really appreciate it. Mac, talk about this. The reason that companies that we trust, you know, retailers like Staples and Amazon and Target and Best Buy, don't really get stained by these conditions is that, technically speaking, these are outside contractors.
Yeah, sometimes. Amazon does their own fulfillment, but a lot of other companies do hire other companies. And then those companies hire temp staffing companies. So even Amazon, who does their own fulfillment, they, you know, it is their warehouse most of the time, but they still hire a temporary staffing company, and that company hires a bunch of their staff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of the people in this warehouse that I was in did not work for this company, right? They worked for a temporary staffing agency. So it does sort of, there's so much removal of responsibility. It's so far away from the parent company that, you know, sometimes when people will sue these companies, it wouldn't be Amazon that you would sue. It would be, you know, a staffing agency that you would sue. And so, you know, nobody's ever heard of those companies, and nobody cares about those companies. And so it doesn't get as much press.
And what does it take to qualify for, say, health benefits and paid time off?
There was no circumstance under which I would have earned paid time off. Mm. I did have what they called a, quote, limited health option. You know, I have the spreadsheet. You could pay into it, and then when you went to the doctor, you know, one time per year that you went, you would only have to pay a $250, you know, payment instead of what it actually was. The limited, that's a very serious limited. It's just like the barest minimum of a little bit of help for a couple of doctor appointments per year.
Mm-hmm. And there were lots of people who were hired on as temporary employees who stayed temporary for months and years on end.
Yeah, there are people who work for these companies in general. The warehouse I was at in Ohio, you know, I asked the supervisor who was there, how long has your longest temp been working here? And she was like, oh, years. Hmm. So, as you know, for years, that guy is still making $9 an hour. And for years, that guy doesn't have real health insurance or vacation, mm-hmm. you know, or sick days. Not only are you not paid for your sick days, but you get points. You know, you get penalty points for your sick days, and you have to produce doctor's notes and things like this. So there are people who do that for years at a time.
You know, the irony of having to produce a doctor's note when you're not provided with health insurance and you need maybe 3 days off for the flu or something is ridiculous.
I know. It's terrible.
Okay, so to what extent are we culpable in all of this, those of us who, you know, I have to tell you, I don't like to shop. If I do shop, I often do it online, and now I'm reconsidering all of that.
I know. I'm sort of like ruining all my friends' lives, right? Like, they're like, why are you always talking about this? I just want to order some crap from Walmart on the internet, and I don't want to leave my house, you know? So I understand that it, you know, nobody wants to hear it. And I feel the same way. You know, I live in San Francisco. I don't have a car. It's so much easier for me to order stuff off the internet. But like I said, people, you know, it's not that people knew and didn't care. It's that people didn't know.
Yeah.
And some of the e-commerce specialists that I interviewed, you know, one who I interviewed for the story was saying, you know, she herself hires third-party logistics companies to do this sort of shipping for her internet retail site. And even she didn't know what it was like inside them. And once, you know, there a certain level of awareness is reached. If somebody created a standard, you know, where you, it would be like organic food, something that you pay more for because it's important to you, there is a segment of the population, I think. I mean, I would pay more if I knew that the company that I was buying online from was not torturing or abusing, you know, poor unemployed people when they ship my products. So hopefully someday there will be a standard for that.
Well, that's the tricky part, too, because, you know, obviously some of this has to do with cost cutting and the need for speed. But there's no guarantee that, you know, shipping something slowly and paying more for shipping at this point guarantees that you are not participating in this kind of worker abuse.
Right. That's true. I mean, you could have a company that still charges for shipping, but still, you know, squeezes extra profits out by squeezing these manual laborers. Sure, that's totally possible. That's why you would need, I mean, it's an issue of transparency, right? There's no way to know unless there's some kind of standard. Because even people who work for these companies, you know, sometimes don't know what exactly is happening inside them. So, you know, it's if they were more transparent, then you could make better consumer choices.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Dick on the line in Plano. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Chris. Love your program as usual.
Thank you.
Maybe you can remember this. I think a couple of years ago you had a gentleman on who was talking about temp labor jobs to go to book. This author sounds very, her observation sounds very similar.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the guy who took an agricultural job.
Yes, I think that might have been it. And it did a bunch of outdoor jobs.
Yeah.
Anyway, my comment is, I know that she bemoans the lack of medical and vacation benefits, but we got to remember that these are unskilled labor positions that no one has been forced to take, and that, quite frankly, they are temporary because the way our economy operates, those companies could go out of business, be replaced by competition, are by automation in the shipping.
What do you think about that, Mac? Thanks. Yeah, I got that. Thanks for your call, Dick.
Sure. I mean, I've heard that point before, right? If humans demand to be treated better, then someone will just invent robots that will be able to ship these packages and things like that. You know, I don't have a solution or enough information about robots to really like speak to that, but certainly the model now is, you know, is abusing people who don't have any other choice. And sure, you're like, okay, but it's a matter of the whole economy because everybody's poor, so everybody needs these discounts and everybody needs to be able to get free shipping, and so nobody can afford to pay the extra, and so these people who are doing the jobs will have to stay poor. I mean, that whole model and that whole argument, that is definitely not, you know, anything that's going to get us progressing toward better labor conditions. We're sort of with that argument, you're sort of undoing what people have tried to do to make labor conditions better. And I agree, this is a low-paying job. This is an entry-level job, for sure. But there needs to be jobs like that in this country. There need to be low-paying and entry-level jobs. But they don't have to be jobs that make it impossible to survive, and they don't have to be jobs that will physically destroy the people who work them. You know, I got an email from a girl last week who had been working at, she was working at Amazon, and she'd worked there for a couple years, and she wasn't a temp. You know, not all these people are temps. Mm-hmm. Some of these are like real staffers. She'd been working for Amazon, and she actually had the same kind of job that I had. And she said that when she, you know, she quit now, and she started going to night school, and now she has a better job. But she, every time she moves her shoulder, her dominant shoulder, it makes a grinding noise. And she's 22, and she, because she started working there when she was 19. It's not acceptable to have people doing permanent physical damage to their bodies for $9 an hour for companies that post billion-dollar profits.
When you would talk to people, the first question that new people would ask one another is, well, why are you here?
Sure, because nobody would take that job if they had a choice. Mm-hmm. Not just because it's low-paying or unskilled, because, I mean, like I said, that is a segment of the, you know, employment picture that is important, but because they treat people so poorly and because it's so bad for you physically. And so everyone did, you know, so, you know, what's your story? Like, why are you here? It's like prison. Mm-hmm. Like, what did you do that this is, you know, what your life looks like now? Like, what are the circumstances that would land you here? Because everyone had a story. Everyone had been fired from some other job, not fired, but laid off from some other job, or the company they worked for before had shut down, or, you know, they just couldn't find any work in this labor market because whatever they had done before wasn't even a job anymore. So, I mean, it's definitely a job of last resort, and the people who own these companies know that, and so they treat people accordingly, just because they can.
In some ways, it sounds like the kind of job that has been outsourced in every other field, except that when you're looking at domestic distribution of products, you really can't send that overseas. You've got to do it here.
I know, right? It's one of the brilliant things about it is it's really hard to make that, oh, yeah, well, they're just going to ship these jobs to China if we keep complaining about it argument in this particular case, because you do actually need to be near the customers that you're shipping to. That's the whole point. So there are tons of these warehouse distribution centers in the United States. It's awesome that this, you know, online industry is creating all these jobs. It's extremely unfortunate that almost every single one of them is, you know, operated with such terrible, terrible conditions that are so bad for the people who work there.
So what do you, I mean, has this changed your personal consumer behavior?
You know, I don't do a ton of shopping online. You know, I live in San Francisco and everybody around here is always talking about trying to buy local,
yeah,
and things like that. So I have, you know, family-owned stores, a lot of family-owned stores right by my house, mm-hmm, and I have always shopped at them. And I was sort of, while I was doing this job, I was sort of promising myself, you know, for as long as you can possibly afford it, you need to keep patronizing these local-owned stores, you know, even though they're more expensive. But that is a luxury,
mm-hmm,
you know. It's a luxury that I can do that because I don't have to feed kids, so I can spend extra money on patronizing local shops because it's important to me. But for as long as people let these companies treat workers and pay people so low, I mean, this is not good for the economy. These jobs are not good for the economy because they are barely paying surviving wages. So for as long as these are the only kind of jobs that people have, nobody's going to be able to afford to patronize anybody other than Amazon or Walmart online.
Any response whatsoever from the third-party fulfillment industry?
Nope.
Hmm. Were you expecting one?
Not really. I mean, if I were them, I'd probably want to. I mean, what are they going to say?
Yeah.
You know, they know that it's that's true. When a series of articles, you know, came out of Pennsylvania late last year, about the conditions at an Amazon fulfillment center there, Amazon posted some sort of extremely generic statement online. You can find it on their website. It says something like, you know, we're really committed to the safety of our workers or something, and like that's it.
Mac McClelland is human rights reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. Her latest piece is I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave in the March-April issue. Mac, thanks once again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.